Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Rebecca Frayray, number 20010, Deputy State Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Ms. Barra. 7 years, 7 months, and one day ago, Ms. Barra filed her notice of appeal in this court. 7 months of that delay, I'm contending, is unwarranted. It's due to record issues, and it is also due to the court's delays in issuing the settlement order and a delay in never ruling on my motion to reconsider that settlement order. Because this divisions of this court and the Supreme Court in the Wong case have said that prejudice is an essential element to a finding of a due process violation, that is going to be what I'm intending to focus on with respect to those first two issues in my brief. Because part of the prejudice relates to issue three, the alleged misconduct in closing argument, I will partially address that issue. I will be happy to answer questions about any of the other issues, but I don't intend to get into them in detail. So I want to start with the meaningful appeal because Wong issued after I had filed my brief, but I think the analysis is the same. Wong relied in heavily on the Harris v. Champion case, 10th Circuit case, and I think that opinion, some of the language was taken right out of that opinion by Justice Hood and Wong, and it provides a lot more detail in terms of the analysis, particularly with respect to the speedy appeal issue. I want to start with meaningful appeal because an appellant has a due process right to a meaningful appeal, which means a complete transcript of the proceedings below and an accurate transcript of the proceedings below. So the focus of prejudice in that context is the state of the record. Are there still gaps in the record? And my contention is yes, there are. And do those gaps impair Ms. Barra's right to raise issues on appeal? Do they relate to the issues in her brief or issues that she could potentially have raised on appeal? If it doesn't relate to the issues, then just because it's missing doesn't establish prejudice. My belief is that yes, there are still gaps in the record. When I began this case, I had a new trial ruling denying a new trial, which said there were numerous objections throughout the closing argument, that they were calculated to thwart the prosecution's argument, that the court admonished counsel at the bench, and that he essentially threatened counsel, I will make these objections, or I'll let the jury know what's happening if these don't stop. And said objections in closing argument are rare, and that his conduct was intended to, quote unquote, put a check on defense counsel's conduct. What I got was a closing argument transcript with two objections, the first one being on the record, the second one beginning on the record and moving to a bench conference, and so I moved to reconstruct the record. The settlement order, instead of reconstructing what was missing, I think created further gaps in the record. The court changed its mind 4 years later and said, oh, I was mistaken because I didn't have a closing argument transcript. All of those objections that I was talking about in my new trial ruling, those happened during the evidentiary portion of the trial where counsel was repeatedly approaching the bench and making his objections at the bench that could have been made in open court more expeditiously, that these objections were at a point when prosecutor was making points with the jury, that I viewed it as hardball litigation tactics that were intended to thwart the prosecution's presentation of its case. And then that settlement order recharacterized what I never thought was unsettled, and that was what happened in the bench conference that defense counsel perceived as a threat, and really softened that and said, I told both attorneys, you need to make your objections in open court. If you make meritless objections, you can't make meritless objections. What I'm saying applies equally to both sides.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Sure. Ray, if I may, please.
Absolutely.
Would you help me with how the court reporter's affidavit and her discussion of the timestamp process, how that applies here? And how that doesn't suggest to us that there were indeed only two objections during closing argument.
Well, I mean, I don't question what the court reporter said, but I think she's a human being capable of missing things. In the March 26th reconstruction hearing, one of the things that was placed on, was discussed in that, is that the court reporter during the trial lost her, had a family emergency, I believe a member of her family passed away, and so she left and came back. I don't know exactly how that real time works and whether she could have made errors in what was in the transcript. I don't know, but it doesn't comport with what the court ruled at the time that it issued its ruling, where everything was fresh in everybody's mind. So I think that it's missing. I mean, now the judge is saying, we have all these objections that happened in the trial, and I have no way of reconstructing that. That's my prejudice. Defense counsel died before the settlement order issued. And so I really don't have any way of reconstructing then what is missing from the trial record. We're missing it one way or the other. If, in fact, they didn't occur in closing argument, then they occurred during the trial, and I can't reconstruct that. I guess I think part of a meaningful transcript is an accurate one, and the Jackson case talks about how there was no due process violation in that case found because what the court was able to reconstruct was consistent with the closing arguments of the habitual trial and was consistent with the reconstruction proceedings. And what we have here is something that's completely inconsistent. The settlement order just is completely inconsistent with the trial record. And
counsel, I have a question about the objections during the prosecutor's closing argument. Sure. I understand your contention to be that there were a number of other ones that weren't in the transcript.
Correct.
All right. Let's assume that's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's no contention that we don't have the entire argument in the transcript, right?
That's correct.
All right. So we have the argument. So,
correct.
So to the extent you think that anything in the argument was objectionable, we could review it assuming that it was preserved.
You could.
Okay. So.
That's what I argued in my brief.
Yes.
You should do.
I understand that. So, on which issues, which statements do you think that makes a difference? Whether we review it for harmless error or plain error?
Well, I think first of all, I'm required in the briefing to put in a standard of review. I'm required to tell you as part of the brief, is it preserved? Where it's preserved? I can't do that. In terms of the analysis, you know, we have the original motion for new trial saying there were all these objections. Now we have a settlement order saying there weren't. I think the McLaughlin case makes clear that as an appellate court, you can't decide. You're not a fact finder. So can you decide, okay, we'll review everything for harmless error. We'll assume that everything was preserved. I think you can. That's certainly what I argued in my brief. But I think in terms of the prejudice to Ms. Vera, there's a big difference when you evaluate it under the plain error standard and the harmless error standard. I'm not saying I never had thought that there was missing argument, okay? Now I don't know. I mean, we're obviously missing something. We're either missing it from the closing argument, which to me makes more sense than missing it from the record, just based on what was said at the time that the new trial motion was argued, what was said in the reconstruction proceedings. I mean, at the end of the March 26th hearing, we were all in agreement. The court, the prosecutor, me, that we were missing objections from the closing argument and maybe they couldn't be reconstructed. If so, fine, say they can't be reconstructed. And then it changed. The prosecutor completely changed his position after submitting several detailed arguments about it being a closing argument. So I think the prejudice to Ms. Vera now is that there are questions about what may have happened during trial that maybe relate to the record issue, the EGC incident report issue, Maybe there are other issues, evidentiary issues that were argued. Maybe counsel asked for a redaction of the whole invocation of rights on the interview with Detective Ashworth. I don't know because I never talked about
it. But I don't recall that there were any such contentions when you went back to resettle the record, that there was a problem with the evidentiary portion of the
nobody
trial.
Nobody told me there was. I got the settlement order, I had no reason to believe that there was any reason, that there was any problem with the evidentiary portion. But now that I have the settlement order, I have reason to believe I'm missing a lot of objections that were made during the trial, and I don't know where they were. I don't know what they relate to. And that's my prejudice. I can't go back and reconstruct that because of defense counsel's death.
But there are objections reflected in the settled record as to the evidentiary portion.
There are.
But
there's only six that were bench conferences. We have 30 that were open court objections. But the court settlement order specifically makes these bench conferences, not open court objections.
Can I ask you about the nature of the threat from the court? Because as I understand it, all the court was saying is that if you continue this way, I won't allow you to approach the bench. You'll have to make your objections in open court, and I will rule in open court. What's wrong with that? That's the typical procedure.
That is, and that's what's in the settlement order, but that's not what he found at the new trial, in the new trial ruling. He said in the new trial ruling that he was detecting a pattern, that you're doing this to interrupt the flow of the prosecution's argument, that these are all meritless objections, and if you don't stop doing them, then I'm going to have to tell the jury what's happening. I think counsel certainly interpreted that as a threat, that the jury would be told these are meritless objections, and so he stopped objecting. Okay. So I think that the settlement order changes that. It changes the character of that. I don't think this court can make a decision which one is correct under McLaughlin, because it's not a fact-finding court. I want to briefly move over to the speedy appeal issue, because there's no contention that Ms. Barra asserted her right. The length of the appeal, I would just refer to the Harris case, which found that 2 years was presumptively an inordinate. Obviously, it's a flexible standard. Sometimes less isn't, sometimes more isn't. But certainly the delay here, I think, is inordinate. The reasons for the delay are attributable to record issues. I didn't get this a complete record from the get-go. And once we did reconstruction proceedings, I continued to try to get the reconstruction into completed. And I never did get the complete minute order, so it's never been completely completed. In terms of and the court's ruling, the court just delayed in the ruling, and rulings by the court that are delayed are not attributable to the petitioner. That's in the Harris case. The Harris cites Hankins v. Fulcomer, which held that. So I think all of the delays are attributable to the government here. Is she prejudiced because of the delay? Absolutely. Defense counsel died before the court issued the settlement order. If the court had issued a timely order, like it said in the reconstruction proceedings, it understood it had to do, and that it would do. I might not be here on this issue. I would have been able to talk with defense counsel about that. But because of the delay, all I could do was to file a motion for reconsideration. And at the hearing before I filed that motion, the court said, yes, I understand. If I get a timely order out, I'm probably denying your motion for a new trial. I understand why you filed that and requested it, but we do need to get the ball rolling here. So I would like to reserve the remainder of my argument for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I too will focus my arguments on the first two or three issues, depending on how you frame it, the meaningful appeal, the speedy appeal, and then, as necessary, the prosecutorial misconduct. But I am fully able to talk about any of the issues should you have questions about the remaining two issues. The crux of the defendant's position here is that unrecorded bench conferences in which counsel issued some objections and may or may not have received a threat to stop issuing objections at the bench instead of in open court have prevented the defendant from exercising her right to a meaningful appeal, a complete record, and by extension, a speedy appeal due to the lengthy reconstruction process. The problem with this position is, as this court suggested in some of the questioning to opposing counsel, that there is no inability to review the record as it stands. We have the transcript of the closing argument. The transcript of the closing argument didn't change from prior to the reconstruction to the reconstruction and resettled record to the court's ultimate settlement order of November 11, 2011. There are three main reasons that we need to talk about the record being essentially fine as it stands, and that's it's defendant's burden to prove that something is in fact missing, and we don't have that. As Your Honor, Judge Bernard, you mentioned, the court reporter filed an affidavit, I believe it was in April of 2010, which is, again, before defense counsel died, and defense counsel didn't meaningfully contest that before the settlement order, saying, I recorded any objection that was made in open court. I didn't have the ability to record things at the bench conference. Again, this was back in 2006. This was before many of the trial courts here in Colorado had auditory recording, certainly at more private bench conferences. The second, as I mentioned earlier, is that we have a full review possible of the closing argument and of the trial transcripts. And it's important also to note that the entire argument only focuses here on closing argument. We're not talking about evidentiary issues in trial. The defendant specifically limited the argument to closing argument, to the discussion of what's going on in closing argument. And this court can review everything that the prosecutor said, everything the defense counsel said during closing argument to determine if there was error. In some cases, were there objections that were issued? And third, there is no error or prejudice in reviewing the closing argument. Defense counsel talked about a sort of a two-pronged approach. Are there gaps, and do they impede the appeal? And the answer to both of those is no. In the first case, we have the bait stamps, as the court reporter suggested, with the time stamps talking about when the objections occurred. We have the court reporter saying, I recorded everything that was made in open court. We have the trial court and the prosecutor both specifically endorsing that in their positions. The prosecutor said, there was no reason the court reporter couldn't be recording things, and the trial court made a finding in the in its settlement order, which I believe is on page 36 to 38 in the supplemental paper record, volume one, talking about how the court reporter was able to transcribe the objections and reflect what was going on in open court.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Michaels, if I may, please.
Please.
How would you recommend that we resolve the conflict between things like the court reporter's affidavit and the subsequent orders and the initial statements by both the court and the prosecution that there were a lot of objections during closing argument? And as Ms. Frayway pointed out, those things were made much closer to the time of the closing argument than the things that we have later.
Certainly. I think a few points are in response to your question. The first is the original discussions occurred right after trial where the focus was not just on closing argument but across the entire substantive portion of the trial as well. And if you look across the substantive portion of the trial, you see objections, I think opposing counsel pointed out at least 30 open court and then 7 to 10 bench objections that occurred over the course of the trial. And so I think a human tendency is to look at all that and think, wow, defense counsel or even the prosecutor objected frequently. And so because they objected frequently throughout the course of the substantive portion, I can impute that to the closing argument as well. But the court was then able to look at the closing argument transcript, and a little reflection cools people's memories and gets them to think more analytically. I don't think necessarily the two positions are incongruous. I certainly think there was a difference between the two, but that's the point of the settlement order and the reconstruction of the record in the first place, is to go back and to think about these things and identify where objections occurred in this case as requested and how they were put forth and how they're presented to the court, be it in open court or at the bench. What we're really talking about here is not what does the record include or exclude. It's very clear that the record identifies all the substantive portions of the trial. And again, the substantive portions of the trial just aren't at issue because they were never raised before this court until today. And to look at what was said in the closing argument, and not that it was never there, we have a closing argument transcript, but rather what we're looking at is the due process of the standard review, essentially. What is the standard reviewing of, not that the record just doesn't exist. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. The defendant actually conceded in our oral argument there was no missing argument going on. It's just a question of what were the objections and what were they recorded and how were they recorded. But there's no substantive difference between the objection and the presentation. This court can look at the closing argument and you can make your own determination of is there something that's objectionable here, either under plain error or even under a preserved standard. It's certainly where the counsel objected. I want to talk a little bit about this idea of muzzling defense counsel of a potential threat, as defense perceived it by the trial court, and saying, I will make you object in front of the jury. As this court knows, there's no statutory or procedural right to object at the bench. So as counsel continued argument throughout the trial, towards the end is where he started approaching the bench to make the objections to interrupt the prosecution's flow, which is all part of a strategic need for a strategic approach for defense counsel to make, and that's fine. But a trial court is allowed to say, I'm going to overrule your objection, I find your objection meritless. If you proceed to object in this manner, and that could be either in this manner of meritless objections or repeated objections or in this manner at the bench, then I'm going to have counsel go back to your table and object from your table in the presence of the jury. Now, if that's a slight shift in how the trial was being conducted, then defense counsel very well might have perceived that as being a threat to expose, quote unquote, the defendant's ability to object in front of the jury, but that's not prejudicial. That's simply trial practice. Counsel, in her reply brief, discussed a little bit about how it was unclear if trial counsel was admonished to this extent while he was at the bench or at trial or at his table in front of the jury. But in the context, it makes clear that it happened at the bench, because a trial court is not going to say, I'm going to send you back to your table and overrule your objections in front of the jury while the judge is overruling his objections in front of the jury. Unless there are other further questions on the deficient record, I want to talk to the issue of the speedy appeal and any prejudice that might have.
Counsel, I'd actually like to turn to the issue of the records,
the medical records.
Yes, the medical records.
Certainly.
It seems to be something rather odd, at least to me, in the law here, that says in the fact that a court can't even take a look at the records to determine whether they fall within the privilege. If a party represents that they do. That just seems rather odd. I mean, how is a court to really know whether the records fall within the privilege or not unless the court can see them?
Your Honor, to speak frankly, that I struggled with that when I was writing my brief. Cisneros is very clear, and Cisneros relied on the district court case, both of which are cited in my brief, that talk about unless there's a waiver, a court can't review them. And the idea behind that is that these documents are privileged and they exceed the scope of confrontation, they exceed the scope of exculpatory information because they are treatment records specifically designed to help treatment. I do find it strange because it essentially means that you have to make an offer of proof as to what the records contain, how they'd be exculpatory, and how they don't impact treatment. And I think that's where the real turn is whether not the content of the records, but whether they impact the treatment specifically of the individuals, the victims, during the course of their treatment. And we have several offers of proof from the EGC, the treatment center, stating why these are treatment documents, why they aren't necessarily salient to the course of the defendant's defense or her theory of defense, but rather they're designed to protect the treatment program of these victims. And both the statute and the Cisneros case and the district court's case all talk about, especially in the context of sexual assaults, the idea of preserving and protecting and promoting the honest and open treatment of these individuals is paramount, and they, again, exceed the confrontation aspect and the exculpatory aspect of the evidence vis-a-vis how it would be presented in trial. I do think it's strange, but that's what we're left with Supreme Court our Supreme Court's case law and the statute as it's written. It basically talks about how exculpatory information just isn't discoverable. But even if that's troubling, I think we can go just a little farther and say, even if they should have been admitted, and there's nothing in the record suggesting that they should. In fact, the offer of proof from the center, it talks about these, essentially the entirety, all the people who are being treated at the EGC center. There was no offer of proof that specifically these three victims were encompassed within these treatment logs. But even if we assume they are, and even if we assume there's a severability that's allowed under the medical treatment review of these documents, which again, case law says you can't have a severability, you can't have this piecemeal approach. But even if we assume all that isn't so, all of this was testified to. Each victim got up there and said to one extent or another, and it's all cited in my statement of facts at the beginning of my brief, all of them got up there and said, look, yeah, she had, we either knew or suspected that she had revoked some of our privileges or imposed some sort of a, I don't want to say punishment because that sounds too draconian, but that's the idea they're trying to convey, that she imposed something, so therefore we would have fabricated allegations against her. That was the whole point of looking into these treatment, these medical documents, is to say, look, they fabricate allegations against me because I impose restrictions on them. And in fact, we know the jury didn't necessarily believe one of the victims and acquitted her of conduct related to the victim, D.I. I also want to emphasize, the prosecution had no involvement whatsoever with the center's records. It was the center who appeared in court, in the trial court, and said, there has not been a waiver of this. There is no reason to look at these records. And so the trial court can't use them, you shouldn't even review them. So it's the center who's the proper party, the treatment center is the proper party, not the prosecution. And to that, I want to emphasize that the prosecution just, we haven't seen them, the prosecution is just not the proper party to be presenting this claim, either at the trial court or on appeal. I want to close by reading a quote from the Huang case because I think it's very instructive and applies here. Huang, at paragraph 42, states unequivocally that simply alleging gaps that likely or even possibly contained essential information that would potentially form the basis of a substantive claim on appeal is insufficient to establish prejudice. So even if we're saying that there are some objections that should have been included on the appeal, even if we're saying that some objections were preserved, even if we're saying that the trial court may have potentially issued a threat to counsel, which that information is still in front of you from the trial counsel's affidavit and from all the parties' positions, which were all rendered before the court issued its settlement order, even if we assume all that, we're simply talking about a small gap that doesn't preclude review. And with that, I ask you to affirm the appeal, affirm the defendant's convictions, unless there are any other questions from this court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Your Honors, I just want to briefly first respond to the state's assertion that defense counsel did not meaningfully challenge the court reporter's affidavit, and I think the record shows that he did. He always maintained there were more objections than were reflected in the closing argument transcript, and even the people's position said that the DA said he could see how there were some missing objections. So I don't think that's supported by the record, and I think the March hearing at the end of that refutes it. Everybody agreed there were more objections than were reflected. The court's statement that you need to make your objections in front of the jury. In order for that to be meaningful, there have to be a whole lot of bench conferences, and there just aren't in this trial. That statement just isn't, again, supported by the record. We have all these objections. Most of them in trial were during open court. The bench conferences were a couple in Detective Ashworth, one in David Maynard, one in Ms. Vera, one in McCoy Heisel. That cannot be fairly characterized as impeding the flow of the prosecution's case in the way that it was stated by the court or by the prosecutor. With respect to the treatment records, Mr. Olt did make an offer of proof. He had an incident report, and he said, here's the conduct at the top. We don't want the treatment stuff at the bottom. EGC agreed, this is a gray area. We don't know. Somebody has to look at it. Ms. Vera said, there are reports that I wrote related to these accusations that I don't have. So, based on all of that, I would ask this court to vacate Ms. Vera's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion, of course. We need to take a short break.